Well, hello, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. I'm your Head School Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. And our topic today is Derry and the North West, 1920 to 1922, War of Independence or Communal Conflict? Now, originally, this was meant to be part of the Dividing Ireland Conference that was to take place at the end of this month. But that was cancelled, of course, like everything else on the planet, due to the COVID-19 lockdown. Nevertheless, we are still grateful to the support from Derry's Nerve Centre and the Tower Museum's Decade of Commemorations project. Now, to discuss our topic today, we're joined by Adrian Grant, Brendan McSwivna, Liz Gillis, and Brian Walker. Okay, now, by the way, another thing about this head school is one of the problems is when looking at the War of Independence and looking at the War of Independence in most of Ireland and what happened in the Northeast. And I suppose there's always the tendency to assume that partition is bound to happen. So there's a tendency, if you like, to push partition backwards into history. So we're going to try and get around that by looking at the whole Northwestern region. In other words, we're going to straddle the border in this discussion. Maybe if we go to the whole panel really is that the first starting point would be the 1918 general election. Maybe Brendan, give us a rundown of what happened in Donegal, because there's that very interesting situation in East Donegal where the Redmond's Irish Parliamentary Party gets a seat. How did that come about?
They got the seat because they had a pact with Sinn Féin to return a nationalist candidate. My interest would essentially be in how small local communities experience this big change. And what one notices about the 1918 election is that there is a very radical moment in West Donegal in which the nationalist bloc, the Irish Parliamentary Party bloc, the Hibernian bloc, if you like, that was very much dominated by the church, it fractures. And the challenge that is brought to it is brought by people who are in many ways new to politics, people who hadn't been in politics before. So you see women as women nominating Sinn Féin candidates in the election. So it's a very it's a very radical moment. But one witnesses too the power of the long established home rule faction with clerical support. So there's no landslide per se for republicanism. It's a fracturing of the nationalist bloc.
Okay, but how many of the seats in Donegal were contested? The ones that Sinn Féin won?
That's a good question, Tommy.
Brian, can you help us out there on that one?
Yes, they're all contested.
They're all contested, right. So yeah, so it is. Contested. So they actually win. And that's important from what you just said there, Brendan. That they don't just get in on a nod.
No, they're contested, and the people, like say West Donegal, it's contested by McMenamin against Joe Sweeney. McMenamin will go through various different political parties in the 1920s and end up in Fine Gael.
Right,
and it's based upon that Hibernian network with clerical support. When one looks at West Donegal, or sorry, South Donegal, which comes up to where I'm sitting at the moment in West Donegal, but for a priest in, I think it was Bundoran, and a priest in Pettigo, there was no clergyman nominated the Sinn Féin candidate, but the church fully backed his opposition.
Okay.
So the church was emphatically behind the parliamentary party.
Brian, can I bring you in here on the situation in Derry?
Yes,
so you've got two county constituencies and the city.
Well, the interesting thing about the city reflects indeed what Brendan has been saying, because in fact in Derry, the Sinn Féin are the minor party. It's the constitutional nationalists are the bigger party in Derry. Sinn Féin really have very little organisation. They're late on the scene. But what happens is that Cardinal Logue then divides up the constituencies between Sinn Féin and the Nationalists to avoid a split vote, a split Catholic vote that will let a Unionist in. And Derry is allocated to Sinn Féin. So Owen McNeill the Sinn Féin member is elected for Derry, and that's what happens.
He's Derry City now, for the city?
For the city, yes.
Yeah.
Now, he's not the first nationalist MP for the city. McCarthy in 1886, I think, was Sinn Féin. It was a nationalist. But nonetheless, it is quite a shock.
And is this a seat that swings back and forth, Brian, between nationalists and unionists?
It has, yes. Yeah, although previously it was held by unionists. The other interesting one, of course, is East Donegal, where a unionist candidate stands, a Major Moore. Now, he's defeated. He wins 5,000 votes. But what's quite interesting is that in 1923, the constituencies have been redrawn. There's a new electorate. There are, I think, eight TDs elected for Donegal. Major Miles, a unionist candidate, he's number one, which is quite interesting.
He could never get elected to Westminster, Brian, interestingly, because Major Miles was the local TD in my part of the woods.
But under a PR system with a multi-member constituency, it's quite interesting. He's elected number one in 1923.
But he couldn't get elected as a unionist when we were part of the United Kingdom. That's just the funny thing about it. So,
It's the PR system that helps him.
Brendan, yeah?
Tommy, if you were to think of the city of Derry, historically it had three major newspapers. The Journal, the Derry Journal, which became a Catholic nationalist newspaper. You had the Sentinel, the Londonderry Sentinel, which was a conservative landlord-supporting newspaper. And the third newspaper was the Derry Standard. And the Derry Standard was a liberal newspaper. You could almost say it was, at times, a quite radical Presbyterian newspaper, if you went back to the 1850s, when it was emphatically in favour of land reform. So you have those three kind of core groups or core poles within the region. Nationalism, conservatism, and then this curious liberal, occasionally radical Presbyterianism. The Home Rule MP for Donegal in the 1880s was Reverend Kinnear, who was a Presbyterian minister.
Right. Adrian, I want to bring you in here because more interesting in many ways were the local elections, which were held in 1919 and 1920. Now, just in terms of, say, Derry City, were they held in 1919 or 1920, first of all, Adrian?
They were held in January 1920 in Derry City.
And what was the pan out there? Because, I mean, nationalists won the corporation, did they not?
Yeah, so Derry City had been under unionist control. Local government had been under unionist control, indefinitely. So there hadn't been a Catholic mayor since Cormac O'Neill was appointed in 1688, just before the siege of Derry. So the city is seen as a bastion of Protestantism, of unionism in Ireland, the maiden city that shall not be breached. So for it to fall into nationalist control in 1920 is a hugely significant moment, not just for the city, but for the entire region.
Sorry, Adrian, to interrupt you. How or why does that happen? What changes that gives a nationalist the upper hand?
Well, it's all down to PR. It's all down to PR.
Okay. So PR was introduced.
PR was introduced. Indeed. So
that's because in Sligo, for example, the opposite was the case, where it actually helped unions to get elected. They just a rather interesting situation. That was the previous year. It was the first time PR was used, actually. But listen, anyway, Adrian, another question I want to ask you about the local election is, how does Labour do? Because this is another element in Derry, is the Labour element. How do they do in the local elections?
Well, Labour in Derry is an interesting case. It's quite different to the rest of Ireland and different to Belfast again. And you find this trend coming back up when you talk about Derry in the Northwest again and again. So the Labour movement in the city was wrapped up in the personality of a man called James McCarron. And McCarron had been a proponent of the new unionism back in the late 19th century. And was a kind of respected local politician and local trade union activist on both sides of the community, but he was also a member of the Home Rule movement.
Going back to the question of nationalists getting control then, and maybe bring Brian in on this, how did this go down with unionists at the time? Presumably there was a shock to them.
It goes down badly with unionists. They've controlled Derry from when these elections have begun, and it's a great loss to them. But an interesting dimension is the person who becomes the mayor is not Sinn Féin. He's not a Sinn Féin candidate. He's a constitutional nationalist, O'Doherty. While he does go to make some changes, on the other hand, he doesn't go as far as perhaps another Sinn Féin candidate would have done. But it's obviously a very challenging time for everybody. There's a great change, and we will see then how people respond to this.
Now, Adrian, I noticed this one in the notes you sent me. There was a proposal to extend the city boundary in 1920. Now, we'll come back to the later gerrymandering. What did this proposal amount to?
Well, there had been an initial proposal in 1918 to extend the city boundary. And because of the introduction of PR, the unionist establishment in the city was quite frightened because, I mean, the population statistic was 56% Catholic, 44% Protestant. But the Unionist Party had 24 seats on the corporation and the Nationalists 16. So you can see the discrepancy there. So with the introduction of PR, there was a big worry in the Unionist establishment that control of local government would be taken over by Nationalists. So they began to redraw the ward boundaries prior to the election in order to copper fasten control of the city through a gerrymandering technique. And then it was later then after the Nationalists actually won the election by only two seats, so there was a majority of one really, they began then to look at extending, or with the extension of the ward boundaries, begin to actually redraw them to have a returned corporation based on what you would imagine it to be in terms of the population figures, rather than what it had been before.
Is that a long-winded way of saying, Adrian, this was not a gerrymander?
Well, I mean, the idea was
a potential gerrymander. You know, no, it's an interesting point. You know, I mean, was this a fair redrawing of boundaries?
Well, it was a redrawing of boundaries based on the 1911 census statistics, right. And that was the idea. And there was also a feeling that there had been a population growth between 1911 and 1920, particularly in the Catholic areas of the city, in the West Ward and in the South Ward. And there was an attempt to reflect that. But no matter what happened in Derry, whether it was the Unionists doing something along the ward boundaries or the Nationalists doing something with the ward boundaries, there was always accusations and counter-accusations about gerrymandering and control. So that it goes on and on, of course, right into the 1960s.
Now, apart from the issue of boundaries, right, what was the record? Sorry, I'll bring in a second, Brendan. Just want to ask Adrian here. What was the record of this Nationalist corporation, given the bad reputation that the Unionist corporation must get in later years?
As Brian has alluded to there, having QC O'Doherty, an independent Nationalist, as the mayor, tempered the radicalism of it somewhat. But he still saw himself as, while neutral between Sinn Féin and the Nationalist Party to some degree, saw himself as a leader of the Nationalist community in its broadest sense. So he tried to reflect some of the Sinn Féin policy. So, for example, he didn't speak out when Sinn Féin brought forward to remove Lord French as a freeman of the city, which enraged the Unionist population. He proposed removing the Union flag from the Guildhall as a gesture of neutrality, but obviously that was taken in a very, very different way by Unionists. But at the same time, later in 1920-21, Oma, Tyrone, Fermanagh had declared allegiance to the Dáil because they also took control of local government, Sinn Féin and the Nationalists there. Pledged their allegiance to the Dáil, and the Belfast Parliament shut them down and suspended those local institutions. O'Doherty and some of the more moderate Nationalists recognised that that would happen in Derry if the Sinn Féiners got their way, and also pledged allegiance to Dublin rather than Belfast. And in the end up, they didn't really pledge allegiance to either side and were allowed to continue in operation. O'Doherty's argument for that was, you know, that they could influence the Boundary Commission when it was established, and that if you had a Nationalist-controlled local authority, that they could make the case much more thoroughly for the inclusion of Derry City in the Free State. Of course, that didn't happen with what happened with how things proceeded thereafter.
We'll come to that later, of course. Brendan, you wanted to come in on that, the question of boundaries?
No, it wasn't quite the question of boundaries. It was just to revert to something that was said earlier about Labour. Yeah. Here, where I'm sitting in West Donegal in 1918, as if you like, the broader nationalist movement split, there was considerable contention about the control of halls and the control of local bands. And there was violence and there was actual death. There was a man killed, a Hibernian was killed outside Glenties in a clash with Republicans in late 1918. And that contention would continue long after the Civil War through the 30s. But there was an incident in Ninfa, just outside Glenties, where there was a dispute over which faction should control the hall. And the dispute was mediated by the priest. And there were rules drawn up for the hall that hung in the hall for decades, that rules drawn up in 1918 that said any political faction may use this hall except Bolsheviks, which I always thought was very good.
Very good.
It's way up in the mountains, and to think that way up in the mountains was this little hall that any faction could use except Bolsheviks.
Now, I want to just move the discussion on here because you mentioned Dáil Éireann and some of the counties owing their allegiance to Dáil Éireann. And of course, on the same day that Dáil Éireann met in January 1919, we had the Sula Beg incident, which many see as the start of the armed conflict. Liz, you've been waiting there very patiently. Can I bring you in on this? When do we first see signs of IRA activity in the Northwest?
You see it pretty early on in terms of raids for arms. And that was sort of generally around the country. 1919 is pretty dominated by getting the guns. An interesting thing about Derry was that it was noted as being one of the easiest places to get weapons than any other town in Ireland. So you do have a sanction.
Why was that?
You have all the UBF have a lot of arms. There was raids on private houses, also the barracks. There was a lot of barracks around. And you have a lot of foundries that were making grenades. One in particular was Craig's Foundry, which was regularly hit by the Derry City IRA. And they actually got a sanction later on from GHQ in Dublin to give the permission to raid for those grenades. And here you have both the IRA and Cumannamon involved in these raids for the grades. One account estimates that they got 5,000 grenades from Craig's Foundry alone. They had a whole network of people that were involved. You have a chap called...
What was the foundry? Who was the foundry making these grenades for? Presumably for the British Army?
The British
yeah,
Army.
Yeah, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like, do people make grenades in Derry for something? Right.
No.
Actually, Liz, before you go on, can I just... want to tease out one thing here, which I think is very important in this discussion about the IRA, in terms of the boundaries, right? Now, where did Derry lie? Because you had the first Northern Division, which is most of Donegal. You have the second Northern Division, which is in Mid-Ulster from the Foyle to the Ban, essentially. So maybe, Brendan, could you shed any light on this, or Liz, where did Derry City lie? Was it in the Donegal Division or the Mid-Ulster Division?
I'd say Adrian would take a better shot.
Or Adrian,
at.
Yeah.
It was in the first Northern Division.
The first division, the Donegal division, yes.
Yeah. It was. The interesting thing about that is you know, it's almost a recognition of the fact that Derry was a majority nationalist city from the mid-19th century and was seen as the county town of Donegal, essentially. Mm. So that the IRA boundaries, not only the IRA boundaries reflected that, the UVF boundaries in 1913 reflected that. The City of Derry Battalion, part of that actually spread into Donegal as well. So there was a recognition, you know, that Derry and Donegal were sort of inextricably linked by both unionists and nationalists. And that comes through in all of the political discussions at this time on both sides.
But this is extremely important, even just psychologically, never mind militarily. You know, the fact that they see themselves geographically as on the western side of the Foyle, if you like. You know, I mean, I think it is important in terms of the mindset then of that. Yeah. Brendan?
If you want to think of it slightly differently. If you use the notion of an internally differentiated region centred on the city of Derry, North Donegal, like stretching as far west as Gweedore, is very much oriented, part of the hinterland of the city of Derry. And the western parishes of Derry, you know, from the Sperrins west, is oriented on the city of Derry. But on the other side of the Sperrins, you know, they're in a very, very different position. So paradoxically, then you have the fact that North Donegal is part of the Derry region, but parts of Derry County aren't that connected with the city at all. And that's worth that's worth bearing in mind. And then when you look at South Donegal, like Bundoran, Ballyshannon, Donegal Town, they're oriented towards Enniskillen. You know, they're not oriented per se towards Derry. So Adrian's certainly right about that. Derry is the capital of North Donegal.
Just that division you just described there is paralleled in sport. Like Derry City, North Donegal is very much soccer in the sense, you know, Paddy Bonner, whereas Derry GAA team is the South Derry, you know, the county area that you just described there, Brendan. Yeah. Liz, I think you're still with us, Liz. Can I just bring you back in, Liz, just to develop again, now that we've sorted out this boundary issue of the IRA's activity, what sort of stuff is happening then, IRA activities happening then, say, in the spring of 1920?
Anna, can I just come in on where Derry actually is? It actually became an independent battalion of the 4th Northern Division later on. But in terms of 1920...
Liz, when you say an independent battalion, weren't they all independent battalions? I thought they all operated, you know, with a very light touch direction.
No, you have it. I was looking at the brigade activity reports and the actual nominal roles. It's clearly stated that Derry City is an independent battalion, so you wouldn't have, whereas others you'd have like the 4th Battalion of the Drum Brigade or so on. It's a weird one that is specifically stated that Derry City is an independent battalion of the 4th Northern Division.
Right. Adrian, you want to come in on that?
The reason for that is a lot of it's down to Pat O'Donnell and has shaken things up in Derry where he wasn't
wanted.
There were
a few Bolsheviks in Donegal.
yeah, indeed. But there was an inquiry into the activities of Pat O'Donnell at this period. He used to come in when he was in an officer position in Donegal. Derry City came under his remit, and he would come in and arrange attacks on the police and army, much to the annoyance of the local IRA officers in the city who wanted to sort of keep things on an even keel, I suppose. So there was an investigation from GHQ then, around how Derry City should be organised. And I think that's where the independent battalion status comes from. It's an independent battalion in that there's no oversight coming in from Donegal, and they were allowed to kind of operate on their own basis within the city, which was quite strange, I suppose, in the general scheme of how the IRA was organised.
Brendan, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I defer to Adrian's vastly superior knowledge on this one, but... Is it not the case that Pather O'Donnell had difficulties with the individual who was appointed head of the IRA in the city? And Pather O'Donnell had considerable support among IRA men in Derry who wanted, if you like, to get stuck in. So like he had a basis of support within the city, but it was the more moderate leadership.
Oh, definitely, definitely, Brendan. I completely agree with that. It was all down to personality. I think O'Donnell wanted to bring Common the Man more into the sphere of activity, and Paddy Shields, who was OC, had some kind of a personal falling out with the Common the Man leadership in the city, and then there was that base of radicals, younger guys within the city who wanted someone like O'Donnell to come in and take the bull by the horns. But it comes down to that personal difficulty, I think, rather than anything else.
From the end of 1920, the Derry volunteers that went to West Donegal, they went to Pather O'Donnell, and like they were all hard men, if you like. You know, these weren't choir boys that went out to West Donegal. So he had an element in the city who were very much aligned with him, is my impression.
Brendan, can I bring in there, right? Because this seems a bit odd, right? You got this Donegal Bolshevik, Pather O'Donnell, trying to stir up trouble in the city, but his own county, our county, Brendan, is fairly quiet in terms of IRA activity, is it not? Why is that?
I've marvelled at it too. Like, I've marvelled at little incidents where I've looked through the IRA pensions claims, and I've looked at little attacks upon ORIC barracks in Fintown or somewhere, and you have dozens of IRA men attacking an RIC barracks that is like two rooms, and they don't progress very far in their attacks. You know, they don't succeed in overrunning them. And you wonder, did they lack a certain killing instinct? There were incidents, like in this town of Ardra, the officer commanding the British Army in the town was staying in a private house, and he would walk to the barracks every day. In August 1920, the IRA attempted to, we're going to attack the barracks, and your man walked by, and they didn't shoot him.
Brian, maybe can I shed some light on this, Brian?
Well, I will, if you like, but I've just commented about Derry. I mean, I don't know how active the IRA was at this stage, because the first time a policeman is killed is not until May 1920. I think it's the first time a policeman is killed in Ulster. So things are obviously hotting up, but it is May 1920. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not sure the IRA were particularly numerous at this stage or particularly effective, but nonetheless, they were definitely a growing force and a new element here.
Now, can I bring Liz in on this? Liz, can you just shed any light on this? And, you know, how active was or was not the IRA in the Northwest at this stage?
Yeah, basically, April is a sort of a watershed moment for IRA activities around the country. So up to that, it would have been predominantly the raids for arms and so on. You have a couple of attacks on police. But in April, the weekend of April 3rd and 4th, you have an order that came from GHQ in Dublin to basically destroy all the income tax records in the offices around the country. So literally, Ireland went on fire.
What was that about, Liz? Why were they targeting income tax offices?
It was basically to undermine the civil administration. So you have the success of 1918 general election, where Sinn Féin was board. You have the success of the rural elections. Sinn Féin were setting up the Republican courts, so they're basically undermining all aspects of the British government's rule, so political, militarily, and then civil. So you have this this action to be sanctioned across the country. And you have a lot of activity around Belfast and so on. Now, on the 6th of April, the Derry IRA do go into action. They try to attack the Custom House, but there was a guard, I think, too many police on duty, so they pulled back. But you see then in May, this is when they go in on the offensive, where they do carry out a number of attacks, not just on the income tax offices, but also on the evacuated RIC barracks. So this is an operation that is sanctioned by GHQ in Dublin across the country. Derry takes part in that. But while that goes on in May, the tensions are rising throughout the city because of the election of, or the appointment of O'Doherty as Lord Mayor. The removal of Lord French from the role of the Freed of the City. There's sectarian tensions building, so this all feeds into it. You have the unionist community thinking that there's going to be another rebellion. Volunteers are going to come in from Donegal and they're going to basically lay siege to Derry, so they're worried about that. And then it just all feeds into May, where it just unleashes a level of violence, as Brian said, the shooting of Detective Sergeant Moroney. There was the violent clash between the Loyalists and the Republicans, Nationalists and Unionists, and he was out of uniform at the time, but there were clashes between the two groups, and volunteers opened fire at the keys, and he was fatally wounded. Died half an hour after he was shot through the lung, and he was the first RAC man to die in Ulster. And then it just increases and increases and increases until we have the events of June 1920.
Hey, before we get to that, I want to just, because mention has been made, I want to ask, get back to you, Liz, about Cumann na mBan. But before I do that, I want to go to Adrian just about the position. We're all familiar with Derry girls, right? But I'm talking about Derry women in general. Played a particular part in the economy of the city, right? Just talk a little bit about that, because did that feed into the either the political, the military things that we are talking about here?
Yeah, as you say, Tommy, the they were the economic driver of the city, really. The shirt factories were the staple industry. There had been attempts to start a shipbuilding industry similar to Belfast, which never really took off. So it was always textiles in Derry were the primary driver. And of course, textiles are a predominantly female employment sector. So Derry has always had that dynamic of a large female workforce. In terms of that translating over into the political realm, you don't see that so much, as far as I can see from the research I've done anyway. Like, you're not seeing coming the man structures coming out of the factories or anything like that. It's coming really from a community, neighborhood-based organizational structure rather than coming from the factories or coming from the workplace. I could be wrong in that. Maybe there's something I've overlooked, but it's not something I found anyway.
Liz, do you want to come in on that, on the coming the man in the city?
Yeah, it's a very small organisation, basically, like what Adrian said, there's only 15 members that I can find on the nominal rolls for Cumann na mBan in Derry City, and they've got, it seems, connections to the volunteers. Roisin O'Doherty, she seems to be very, very active. She was from a Republican family. Her brother, Joe, was a member of Derry City IRA. Their father was Republican even before the Independence Fund had been set up in 1917, like after 1916, to help the families of those who'd been arrested or killed. Their father was helping people out that were in dire need. She later became a full-time organizer for Cumann na mBan. She was sent to Belfast for 2 years, became captain of the branch in Belfast, but returned to Derry in 1919. And she is one of them that was ferrying grenades all over the place. So between Derry, Belfast, down to Dublin, as one fellow said, that she would often carry a suitcase full of ammunition or grenades and detonators. She'd carry them in her hair. Our house was raided loads of times. And she's then appointed full-time organiser for Cumann na mBan. So what you have throughout the War of Independence, a bit like the IRA, where you had quiet areas, there were commanders or officers sent from Dublin or from busy areas to organise the local level, so set up new companies of volunteers. And you have that with Cumann na mBan as well. So Roisin O'Doherty is one of those women sent to set up new branches of Cumann na mBan. There, one thing that she also did, while she's not only carrying dispatches, carrying ammo, she's helping with the Dáil Loan. She's also looking after prisoners that were in Belfast jail. She's looking after prisoners in Derry jail. One of the things, you find that one of the things women are really good at, and not just in Derry, but in Dublin, was actually getting weapons, how they came across weapons. And there's a funny story with Roisin in that she was involved in a play, so just a local theatrical group. But one of the girls that was an actress, her father was the local DI, and for some reason they used his gun as a prop, and Roisin subsequently stole it, and that was ended up with in the hands of the local IRA. So she's very, very resourceful. And then she herself is involved in the riots that happened in June. She's right in the centre of the action. Again, looking after the garrison in St. Columb's. She's bringing dispatches, ammunition all across the city. And she continues that work right through.
You want to just come in quickly? I want to go on to Adrian about the events of June. So just, if you want to come in quickly.
Just very quickly, in terms of the perceived low level of activity in County Donegal, there's an interesting remark made by Joe Sweeney, who was the TD MP for West Donegal. He was looking for weapons from Collins, and Collins said, "Can you not just go get them?" And Sweeney had to explain to him that you need to understand, he said, that here we are not the majority. You know, he hadn't had a landslide victory. You, within the nationalist community, you had a rival organization in the form of the AOH. You know, there wasn't universal support for the IRA, and there was organized opposition to it, in fact. And the second one then is Charlie McGuinness, who we can talk of again. But when he went through his various pension claims in the 1930s, as did others, they talked about how they found it difficult to draw out the British. You know, that they found it difficult to get the British to engage them. What makes of that, you know, is a different matter.
I want to move on to Brian, quickly.
Can I comment on Donegal? Donegal is very interesting, totally different from, say, Cork. Now, Desmond Murphy has calculated that in the War of Independence, what were lives lost in the War of Independence in Donegal? He says there were 12 lives lost, 6 police, 4 volunteers, and 2 civilians. In Cork City and County, there are 108 police killed. That's compared to 6 police in Donegal. 205 civilians are shot by the IRA in Cork, allegedly informers. But many were not. Peter Hart has pointed out ex-servicemen, tramps, Protestants among these people who are killed. But this doesn't happen in Donegal. Now, how do we explain this lack of intensity of violence? Ogun Ozekar and Desmond Murphy point to many things, such as the presence of these constitutional nationalists. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. There's also a substantial Protestant population. There's clerical hostility. But also, it seems there's a determination not to descend to the lower level of violence. And what happens in Cork is what the Bishop Colohan called a devil's competition of murder and arson. Terrible deeds by one side are matched by terrible deeds by the other. But that doesn't happen in Donegal. There's a layer of civilization that remains, and people avoid these extremes. Now, the IRA in Donegal do have success. They drive the army and police out of West Donegal. But you don't see this descent into nasty things that happen in Cork. And it's very commendable that this is how the War of Independence was fought in Donegal. It wasn't fought in this narrow sense that was in Cork.
Just say, guys, that our next Hedge School, right? Our next Hedge School will be looking at Cork, right? So we're going to go into that in detail. No, listen, Brendan, no, I want to move on, right? Because I just want to get on to the events of June 1920 in Derry. Adrian, could you just give us a rundown what happened? Because this is when it all kicks off big time in Derry City. So what happened? How many people were killed?
Well, there's so much in this that I'll have to give you a very brief overview of the week. But there were 20 people killed across the course of the week. The number of injured wasn't measured because the confusion was such that people weren't attending hospitals or anything like that to be seen to. And there was just no way of counting the number of people who were injured, whether that was through gunshot wounds, attacks, physical attacks, or anything else. But what happened was, on the night of the 18th and into the 19th of June 1920, a group of gunmen emerged from the Fountain area of the city, which was a Unionist stronghold in the city and remains so today. And they began firing into the crowd in Bishop Street, right in the centre of the city, the Diamond in the city. A number of people were killed immediately, shot dead at the scene. And the IRA began returning fire, probably
an unprovoked attack. Now, Adrian, what provoked this attack? I mean,
well, consider what we've just been talking about and the escalation of tensions from April and May, the killing of Detective Sergeant Moroni, street violence every weekend, revolver fire every weekend. It was just a matter of time, I think, before this escalated into something much more serious, and that's what happened that night. So the IRA mobilise, they march from the Bogside to St. Columb's College on Bishop Street, which is the same street where all of this began. And then you have two militias, I suppose is what you could call them, fighting against each other. So it's more than sectarian rioting. It's referred to as the Derry Riots or the communal conflict and things like that. But, I mean, you had two well-armed groups engaging each other in urban combat. The Irish Independent described it as war, pure and simple. Charlie McGuinness said Derry was like a town on the Western Front for that week. So it's much more than just a skirmish or a riot. It was pure warfare. So this goes on throughout the week. There's a lot of sectarian targeting involved. The UVF, or the nascent UVF, as it was, more of a loyalist vigilante group at that stage, but becomes a reorganized UVF within a few days of the events. We're targeting Catholics, obviously. Republicans were also targeting Protestants. There were a number of people beaten. Someone was drowned in the Foyle. And the son of the governor of the Apprentice Boys in the city was targeted and brutally murdered in the city by the IRA. So these events were such that people couldn't leave their homes. Martial law was declared, curfew, and it went on throughout the course of the week. It was only brought to a close, really, when the army was deployed. There had been a large army presence in Ebrington Barracks in the city, but they didn't have the numbers to contain this. So there was reinforcements brought in from Belfast. And eventually then the IRA retreated out of St. Columb's College and calm was restored. There's so much going on in that week that we don't have time to get into today.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, is the role of the Redmondite volunteers, or national volunteers, as they had become known. What was their role?
I think this sums up a broader process here with what's going on between the IRA and the old Redmondite volunteers. In August 1919, during the Feast of the Assumption, when nationalists, Hibernians, traditionally marched in the city, the nationalists and the Republicans marched together, and they had portraits of Padraic Pearse and John Redmond together marching through the city. So there was almost a coming together of these two traditions. This is even before the elections, the local elections in 1920. But once the hostilities in June 1920 commence, the Redmondite volunteers immediately come to St. Columb's College, to the IRA garrison, and offer their support. These are nationalist veterans of the First World War, many of them well-trained sharpshooters who were able to defend the college, defend the nationalist community. So you then have veterans of probably the 36th Ulster Division fighting against veterans of the 16th and the 10th or other nationalist identified regiments in the city of Derry. So it's a really interesting dynamic. You also have guns coming in from Donegal, from the Redmondite volunteers. And the chief inspector of Derry City later in the summer notes that many of those who identified as Redmondites had joined the IRA by the end of the summer.
Now, Brian, I want to bring you in here. I want to just pull back a little bit from the local situation in Derry, the wider situation, because by the spring of 1920, the British government had pretty much accepted a six-county Northern Ireland.
I wonder, please, would you let me just comment on the situation in Derry, if I may?
Yeah.
Contrasting it to Belfast. Now, the riot in June in Derry is regarded as the most serious riot there's ever been in the city. It equals in number the riots that occur in Belfast in July. There are about 20 people killed, I believe, in Derry in June. There are 20 people killed in Belfast. However, from that time on, the two cities merged completely, because Belfast goes on to worse killing. And in fact, over the next 2 years, nearly 500 people are killed. But in Derry, this doesn't happen. In Derry, over the next year, 2 years, perhaps a dozen people are killed. There's a complete pulling back. Now, there's still actions going on. There's still controversy, death. But what's remarkable is that this doesn't happen in Derry. Now, the question is, why does that happen? Why does that happen? Well, Ozdecker, the historian, has suggested that because of what happened in June, this caused the UVF and IRA to rein in their followers. So the followers are still active, but they're reined in, and this is not allowed to happen again. Other things are important. Church leaders, civic leaders come out and speak against the violence. This is significant. Then, on the other hand, there's a strong military presence from then on. The city is heavily garrisoned. The B specials come in, so there's a strong military presence, and therefore there's a fall in IRA activity. IRA members go elsewhere in some cases, but there's certainly a decline in activities, and it's remarkable how the city does not follow the line of Belfast to get worse. It actually, things are held together.
Brendan, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, there's one of the more interesting Bureau of Military History memoirs is by Mick Sheeran, who was involved in the street fighting in Derry in June 1920. And he refers to it as having released the killing instinct. And a lot of the people in whom the killing instinct was released, like himself, he himself went to Donegal shortly thereafter to prepare for flying columns to go into Donegal and to dominate the countryside, per se.
Now, I want to go back to Brian, the question I wanted to ask you, just pulling back a bit to the wider political situation, because, as I said, by the spring of 1920, British government had pretty much decided upon a six-county rather than a nine-county Ulster or Northern Ireland. And in a sense, then unionists, it seems to me, are getting on with the job of building government structures. And of course, part of that then is, so in other words, partition is on the agenda, number one. And then by October 1920, the Ulster Special Constabulary is established. You've already established that they were deployed in Derry straight away. Is that correct?
Well, they're deployed in Derry probably from January 21. I mean, they come into existence in the
relatively late,
but that's true elsewhere.
Yeah,
They only come into existence in November, and they're deployed in Derry, I understand, in early January of the following year.
Now, Adrian, does this seep into the general discourse? I mean, I'm trying to think like Brexit. You know, is it there in the background? Nobody worries about it until it actually happens, right? So, is there this threat of partition? Then does this change the game in any way?
It's my firm belief that partition had been on the back of everyone's minds the way Brexit has been with ourselves from 1912, and it drives almost everything in the Northwest in this period. So it's always there, and as each stage of the partition journey takes place throughout the 1910s and into the 1920s, it becomes more acute. But I suppose at this point in time, nationalists and republicans are almost entirely reliant on the sort of pulling the wool over their eyes or putting the blinkers on, and putting faith entirely almost in the Sinn Féin idea of a 32 county republic, and worst case scenario for Derry nationalists and Derry republicans was a six county Northern Ireland with Derry City removed into the southern parliament or the southern jurisdiction, whatever that would turn out to be.
Tell you, I'll come back to that in a second, but I just want to wrap up on the War of Independence itself. So bring in Liz and maybe your Brendan in. First of all, I'm intrigued by this character, Charlie Nomad McGuinness. Brendan, who was Charlie McGuinness? Because he plays a big role in this. And I want to talk about his role in the escape of Frank Carty from Derry Jail in February 1921.
Yeah.
Maybe Brendan first. Charlie McGuinness.
Well, Charlie McGuinness was a merchant seaman from Derry. He returned to Ireland from abroad in, I think it was 1920, and he involved himself in the IRA. In the 1930s, he wrote a memoir, and his memoir was published as Sailor of Fortune on one side of the Atlantic and as Nomad on the other. And it's told in the style of an adventure story. Okay, so it's told, and the style of it I think Adrian may have called him a Walter Mitty on some occasion, and I'd have more time for his text, perhaps. I think his text suffers because of the manner in which it is told. But he was genuinely a very remarkable man. He was Michael Collins' most successful gun runner during the entire period, bringing in a large consignment of weapons from the continent. So he's a larger-than-life figure. But he has issues, shall we say. There's a very good sprawling biography of him by John McGuffin and Joe Mulhern, and it details his anti-Semitism. It details his misogyny, and so on and so forth. So he's an imperfect human being in many ways. But anybody who knew him, Republicans, Free Staters, nobody really has a bad word to say about him.
Was he another Bolshevik, Brendan?
No, but he did go to the Soviet Union. His book was written in the early 1930s. He was in the Soviet Union for part of the period in which he wrote it. He was north of the Arctic Circle. And he ended up going to Spain. He went out to fight on the Republican side. He came home extolling Franco.
Right.
He was interned so, just the second.
Sounds like another head school topic there, Brandon. Liz, could I bring you back, Liz, on the jail escape, which sounds like a kind of an IRA spectacular, the jailbreak of February 21.
Yeah, so this is Frank Carty, and Frank Carty was actually the OC of Sligo, the IRA there, and this fella just could not be kept within the walls of prisons. He'd already escaped from Sligo jail in 1920. Then he was arrested, and he was then taken to Derry jail, which was seen to be escape proof, so no one was getting out of Derry jail. But there was a tobacconist shop across the road from Derry jail, which has been called like a Republican post office, because the family that ran it were sympathetic. They were sending in messages through friendly warders into the jail. Carty wants to get out. So McGuinness is involved in this plan with a number of volunteers. So basically, Frank Carty, in February 1921, he was in the hospital of the prison. He had been wounded in the wrist, at his arrest, I think it was. But the hospital actually backed out onto the yard, the prison yard, which backed out onto houses on Harding Street, I think it was, which was a predominantly Protestant Unionist area. But there were a number of Catholic families in that street. So the IRA made contact with a friendly family, the Heaneys, and the plan was that they would go into their house. They would go out the back garden. They would have made a rope ladder. They would throw this rope to Carty in the prison, and then he would somehow make his way out. They sent in a hacksaw, he would cut the bars, and then he would make his way out of the prison. But the first attempt, something happened with the rope, as is the case with a lot of these escapes. It didn't happen on the first attempt. So it was decided, try again on the 15th of February, I think around 4:30 in the morning. So curfew was on. Now, the Heaney family, who had let the volunteers in, because a number of volunteers took part in the operation, they weren't there. So the volunteers had to break into the house. They made their way to the back garden. They had to get across a number of back gardens because they didn't exactly know where the room was that that Carty would be coming from. So they had carried the makings of the rope ladder in their socks, walking through the streets. They threw the rope over the wall. Carty was then to take that rope. Now, if you can imagine, he gets this rope that's attached to a rope ladder hanging over the prison wall. He was to tie that to the bars or wherever bars were left, or something strong in his cell. He was then to climb or swing like orangutan like across from his cell to the prison wall. There's a drop of about 20, 25 feet. Then he managed to do that, got over the wall, got into the back garden, and they got away. They didn't realise for about 2.5-3 hours later that he'd actually escaped. He hid out in Derry for about a week or so, then made his way to Glasgow, where he was then again rearrested, and he was put in prison, and another escape attempt was made, but that one, it failed. Just in terms of prison escapes, because there's some amazing prison escapes, but just to tie back with Cumann na mBan and Donegal, Ethna Coyle, she doesn't get a mention. She should be mentioned. And she was an organiser for Cumann na mBan. She joined in 1918. Leslie Price had been sent from Dublin to organise Cumann na mBan in Donegal. She comes down to Dublin, does a lot of work for Cumann na mBan, sent up to Roscommon to organise Cumann na mBan there, where she was arrested. Now, she was sentenced to 6 months in prison, but this is towards the end of the War of Independence. She was sent to Mountjoy Jail. In Mountjoy Jail was Linda Cairns and a number of other Cumann na mBan women. Now, she had only to serve 6 months of her sentence. As she said, she was bored. She wanted to get out. It was during the truce. And she, with Linda Cairns, May Bourke, and another woman who I always forget her name, they escaped from Mountjoy Jail during the truce and ended up in Duckett's Grove in Carlow. So just think it's right to mention it's only Gaul woman. As soon as they were talking about Darien's and
we did a head school in Duckett's Grove a few years ago, by the way, just you know, now that you mention it. By the way, listeners, Liz, when explaining that jailbreak, she actually physically demonstrated the whole thing. You will not be able to see, right? The sooner we get back to the live show, the better. Brendan, yeah.
Something in relation to that. There's the, when Ernie O'Malley interviewed Joe Sweeney, he interviewed Joe Sweeney and Paddy O'Donnell together, and he interviewed them separately, and I forget where it is, but he refers to McGuinness having shouted to Carty, or hissed to Carty. Carty was a big, heavy man, and he was reluctant to go across the rope, and McGuinness hissed to him, are you going to leave the fucking place or not? You know, that...
Yes. Now, I want to move on to just the truce. Adrian, what's happening then in this neighbourhood, like, you know, from the truce up to the treaty, say, right? Because it's not like this is now a liberated zone or whatever, right? You know, this is still firmly occupied by Specials, British Army, and so on.
Interestingly enough, there's a real change in the atmosphere. Brian referred earlier to the number of security force personnel in the city. It was 10% of the population were security force by the time the Specials were mobilised. And all of that. So that had changed things. But then the truce and the treaty, the IRA became legitimised. So Charlie McGuinness actually arrived back in Derry during the truce period and paraded up and down the street in his volunteer uniform. And this was happening across the city, across County Derry as well, in areas that were mixed Protestant Catholic areas, and the presence of these IRA volunteers in full uniform, in some cases putting up roadblocks and checking people's identification, was a like a red rag almost. You know,
can this be seen as needlessly provocative? I mean, is this just coat trailing?
Well, yeah. I mean, in County Derry in particular, this had a really negative effect on relations between the two communities. You had training camps take place up in the Sperrin Mountains for the 2nd Northern Division. Charlie Daly was in charge, or one of those in charge up there. And this was seen as the IRA preparing for the next round, essentially, which is what they were doing. You know, there's no doubt about that. But the roadblocks, the checkpoints and all of that was probably needlessly provocative to such an extent that there is a member of the Specials, his name escapes me now, from South County Derry, who made that point. He said that if this continues, that he'll be unable to control his men and a bloodbath will be unleashed. And that's exactly what happened then in that period. But there was massive sectarian violence in South County Derry and parts of Tyrone then, in that period.
Now, eventually, of course, the treaty is signed in December 1921. And the Northern Ireland issue is kind of sidelined by the Boundary Commission. Now, before, I don't talk about the leaked report in 1925, but what was the response to the prospect of a boundary commission? Brian, I want to go to you on this, because is there a sense that Derry City, certainly Derry City nationalists, were kind of lulled into a false sense of security, that they'll be grand, they'll be part of the southern state in the redrawn boundary?
Well, I think for many nationalists and Republicans, the boundary commission gave hope that change would be brought that would remove several of the counties from Northern Ireland and make an important difference. The same thing, of course, horrified unionists. And unionists then responded by taking steps to make sure this wouldn't happen. And so, first of all, PR is abolished. Then the boundaries are changed. The Leach Commission is set up to decide new boundaries. Now, nationalists and Sinn Féin boycott that. So unionists have free rein in this commission for drawing up the new boundaries. And when they do that, it's in direct response to the boundary commission. Michael Collins realizes this in June, gives off to Churchill because of the abolition of PR, and he says, you know why they're doing this? They're trying to paint counties Tyrone and Fermanagh orange in anticipation of the boundary commission. Ernest Blythe in 1924 says that he disapproves of what happens about the boundary changes, about the gerrymandering, but he says he understands it. And he's quite concerned, he's quite convinced that if it had not been the question of the transfer of territory, the same things would not have happened. And now, of course, Blythe knew exactly what was going on because he himself in the southern government had taken similar steps against counties where they felt that they didn't accept the state, such as, for example, Cork and Leitrim were just closed down and commissioners set up. So it's in direct response to this, and that's what happens. The boundaries in Derry are redrawn. The abolition of PR then is effective, and this has important consequences for a number of the councils in the west of the province.
This marks which can only be described as an utter disaster for the nationalist position in this region, right? Because at the same time, civil war breaks out in the south, right? Now, can I go to you, Brendan, on this? Because I was chiding you earlier for the lack of activity in Donegal during the War of Independence. But that's not the case in the Civil War. It's fairly bitter in Donegal, is it not? Or have I got that wrong?
No, it certainly is. And you have a number of factors at work there. That with the notion that there was going to be a northern offensive, you have southern IRA men come north. And they are to participate in a northern offensive. You also have IRA men from the city of Derry who leave Derry and come into northeast Donegal. So sitting around, in particular, the town of Raphoe in late spring 1922, you have large numbers of hardened IRA men from the south. And you also have what some people might say was a kind of a lumpen element that has come out of Derry. They're sitting around, nothing's happening, there's a lot of heavy drinking, and it becomes very, very messy very, very quickly. And that's the context in which, when the Civil War does kick off, the IRA structures in northeast Donegal collapse rapidly.
Yeah, but is there a sense that nationalists, stroke Catholics, the way you want to call it, repeatedly make this mistake of not participating in various possible forums of negotiation? You referred to this, Brian. And this sets up a pattern right up until the recent peace process, one could say, you know. And of course, once they opted out, they weren't invited back in again by the unionists, that's for sure, you know. But it does not sort of set a pattern then of unionists just kind of getting on with building state structures, nationalists ignoring it in the hope that something else is going to save them, like the Boundary Commission?
Well, you're right. I mean, the two communities stay apart. And if you contrast what happens down south, the Republicans are against the state, but they come into the state. The state welcomes them in. They are able to change things and get back control of some of these places that have been taken from them. So there is this democratic consensus. Now, that doesn't happen in Northern Ireland. Nationalists are reluctant at first to come in. They do come into the parliament, but then feel they're not getting being listened to sufficiently. There's a failure to create a consensus. There's a failure to acknowledge that people have got to work together. And the whole question of the state then, of course, remains important. The existence of Northern Ireland remains important for unionists and nationalists, and this continues to dog efforts to create better government.
If you were to go back, Tommy, to where you originally began, you know, we were talking about the region, we were talking about organisation and so forth. If you are from Letterkenny, if you're from Buncrana, if you're from Clifford, the notion that you're going to have a border, it's very hard to wrap your head around. The notion that Derry City, you're, as Adrian called it earlier, the capital of Donegal, that this can be in a different state, that's a very difficult concept for people. So they didn't expect the six counties to exist for another 100 years. You know, it was very, it didn't make sense.
Yeah. Adrian, you want to come in on that?
Just one point on the boycott of the institutions and the disengagement from process by nationalists in the Northwest. That was under encouragement from the Southern Republican leadership. The Dublin government, the Free State government, paid the salaries of teachers in Northern Ireland, nationalist background teachers of Northern Ireland, so that they wouldn't engage with the new state. And non-engagement with Belfast, with the Belfast Parliament and the government, was, you know, government policy. So essentially, nationalists in the Northwest in this period felt that they had the backing of the rest of the country with them on this non-engagement. But when the civil war kicks off, there's an abandonment, I suppose, is the argument that I'm making. And particularly after Collins is killed. Collins had been planning, as Brendan referred to there, you know, the northern offensives, but also other things in the background. There was the diplomatic side of Collins, and then there was the kind of the revolutionary side, and those two things were operating together in terms of a response to Northern Ireland and the existence of Northern Ireland. When the Civil War breaks out, priorities are elsewhere. After Collins, after Collins is gone, the priority of the border and Northern Ireland sinks way down. So that by the time the Boundary Commission reports, the consolidation of the 26 county state is the top priority for the Free State government. And that's wrapped up in the shelving of the Boundary Commission report. In large measure, the Dublin government's reason for acquiescing in that process was really because of the debt cancellation that went along with it, that the British government offered.
No, but isn't the leaked Boundary Commission report would have come as a particular shock to nationalists of the Northwest, because not only was the boundary not going to be the River Foyle, right? It was being pushed a considerable distance westwards into East Donegal.
Yeah, indeed, and the liberties of the city and into East Donegal is right. And it was a shock. It was a massive shock, because even back on the first partition proposals, or the first serious partition proposals in 1914, there was an acceptance, I think, even by the British government, that Derry City would be classed as a county in its own right, and that there would be county plebiscites. So a referendum essentially in each county of whether you wanted to remain under Westminster rule or go under the Home Rule Parliament. So there was always this feeling that Derry City's nationalist majority would always ensure that its constitutional future or constitutional status would reflect that nationalist majority. When that didn't happen in 1924-25, it was a massive shock to the system.
Can I comment? Can I comment on Donegal again, if I may? What is unique about Donegal, the civil war there, is how the two sides were drawn up. Now, when the treaties passed, the council, the county council, passed a motion in support of the treaty, and apparently over 90% of Irish volunteers in Donegal joined the Free State Army or support the treaty. But their opponents are then these people who've arrived as to be all part of the Northern Offensive. They come from Kerry, they come from Cork, they come from Derry and Belfast, who are very much against the treaty. So you have the extraordinary war between these two sides, quite unlike the civil war you find elsewhere.
Brendan, you want to come in on that? It's an interesting point.
What's interesting, when you look at an awful lot of people who subsequently re-emerged as Republican, after the Civil War, like people who ended up in Fianna Fáil, people who ended up in Sinn Féin. During the actual Civil War, large numbers of those people were neutral. You know, that there were large numbers of people who didn't take either side of the local IRA, that they stayed, local IRA men stayed out of it, or some local IRA men stayed out of it. Doesn't mean all did.
Yeah.
But certainly, they managed to not be active in the civil war. I know that from my own kind of extended family. What I've always noticed about it and found interesting is that Charlie Daly and his group, as they were pushed out of the Lag, and as they're pushed out of Glenbey, they're pushed up not too far from where I am now. They're pushed up through Glenfinn into central Donegal. They're pushed through the poorest part of the county. Yeah. And they write about this, that they could not believe the poverty of the people, you know, the mountain people of Donegal. They couldn't believe the poverty of them. And they were tagged all the way by Joe Sweeney's network of supporters and the church. The priests were against them. Sweeney had informers, and the people were extremely poor. But they several of them, O'Donoghue, Daly, they mention the poverty of the people.
Now, I think we've wrapped things up there, guys. Just something that strikes me. I just want to go to you, Adrian, right? Because What we've just discussed here, it seems to me, at the end represent a total victory of unionism. You know, there's no doubt about that. They took control of the city, Northern Ireland was established, etc. But, I mean, it's an interesting it's an interesting case that sometimes too big a victory causes problems subsequently. In other words, like that in a sense, they had tried to take, you know, digest Derry City and maintain control of it. And of course, they couldn't in the long run. And it's kind of ironic then that Derry was the very place, the crucible of the civil rights movement in the 60s. And in many ways, you could argue it's where the more recent Northern Ireland troubles kicked off, you know. So I, given that that's the case, Adrian, why haven't we heard more about this before? You know, like this is never really, you know, Derry Northwest is rarely front and center of discussion of the War of Independence.
Yeah, this is something I'm really interested in, the historiography and the memory, the community memory of this, of these events. On the historiography side, there hasn't been a sustained interest from historians, I think, in the Northwest or in the North in general. You know, it's only in the last 10 or 20 years that we've had people like Robert Lynch come on and write the history of the Northern IRA. Others have done those the regional studies, and that is adding to this. So when we look at the general history of the period now, we do consider the North more so and the regional variations and the colour that that can bring to the history of this period. Community memory is a really interesting one. I mean, this isn't hugely known about in Derry. There are people who know about this. If this conference that we're supposed to be doing this as part of had gone ahead, we were hoping for hundreds of people to come into the Guildhall and listen to us speak for a few days about all these issues.
It'll happen eventually, Adrian, right?
Oh, definitely. We'll have to make it happen. But I don't have an explanation for this, but at the same time, there's possibly something going on here in terms of suppression. This was a defeated community. These kind of things weren't really spoken about with any pride, I don't think, in the 20s, 30s and on in. I mean, if you compare, I remember looking at the nominal rolls and the creation of the old IRA associations when the army pension or the military service pensions were offered in the 30s and 40s. And there's a letter in one of the Derry files where the RUC raid the first meeting of the Derry old IRA brigade. Now, these guys, these old IRA associations in the Free State obviously could operate freely and with pride, I suppose, is the thing. In Derry, they were being raided. All the future mail had to be sent via Buncrana and Carrigart and places like that in Donegal. So there's that whole thing going on of community suppression of memory. The other thing that I think maybe has a big impact here is the intensity of the memory of the Troubles on people in this region.
The recent
nowadays.
Troubles, you mean?
The recent Troubles, Adrian. Yeah, the recent Troubles.
And you're saying it has blanked out what went before to some extent?
To a large extent, I think it has. So you have the suppression of the memory, first of all, by the generations pre-Troubles. There's probably a bit of chatter about these kind of things within Republican communities in Derry, you know, prior to the Troubles. But I think, you know, when we look at this time period where we sit today and we look at the history of Derry and the history of the Northwest, where the intensity of the Troubles and the freshness of that memory and the trauma that still exists because of those 50 years of communal conflict, you know, that is front and center and possibly pushes the memory of this earlier period deeper underground. But hopefully through forums like this and centenaries and things like that, we can begin to look at it afresh.
Brendan, can I ask you, like, just because it's very clear, like, where the perception amongst Northern nationalists that they'd been abandoned by the South, you can see clearly where they come from, and it's very pretty solidly based. As a fellow Donegal man myself, right, I have to say that there was always the impression I got that Donegal people felt they'd been abandoned as well, that they had suffered hugely as a result of this partition settlement.
I think that's fair to say that there was perception, and rightly so, that they were cut off. Like Ballyshannon, there was one bridge connecting most of Donegal with the rest of the southern state. You had to cross the border twice to get to Dublin. The county, as I've said, has large pockets of poverty historically. And yeah, there was a great sense of disillusionment within it in the middle of the 20th century. The population had been falling from the famine, scraping bottom through the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. The population only started to go back up in the 1970s. So it was, you know, there was a certain melancholy to the place as well.
Brian, I could bring you in for the last word on this.
Well, by way of final observation, I mean, by 1925, unionists had regained Derry. The Northern Ireland boundaries were now secure. But in the aftermath, I think an opportunity was lost to try and heal some of these divisions. These divisions were very apparent. And it was a loss for everybody that something couldn't be done to try and heal them. What was essential was that some sort of democratic consensus be formed between the different groups in Northern Ireland, in Derry, and that didn't happen with unfortunate consequences for us all.
I just say, Adrian, it seems to me that has that been addressed to some extent? And obviously, it's now a nationalist-controlled city, right? But I've been there, visited several times. For example, I always find it interesting that the apprentice boys of all the loyal orders are the apprentice boys of Derry, are the loyal order most prone to engage with local communities. And the result is that they've resolved many of these marching questions in the cities.
There has been fantastic work done in the last 10 to 15 years on that side of things. It's a nationalist city, all right. Derry is being held up as a model now for community relations in the north. And there's a project actually ongoing called the Derry Model as a means of trying to learn from the last few decades of community relations, successful community relations in the city, and transfer that to other parts of the north. But in saying that, there is an underlying, there are a lot of underlying issues that aren't being addressed. There is a so-called dissident Republican activity in the city, as we all know now from the killing of Lara McKee last year. The unionist population of the West Bank of the city feels quite aggrieved about that process of the population decline and the movement across to the waterside. All of those issues are still there. They're still bubbling under the surface. There's great work going on in terms of community relations, but there's a lot more to do, I think.
Okay, I think I'll leave it there, guys. I think we've had a very comprehensive discussion here. So I'd like to thank Adrian Grant, Brendan McSwivna, Liz Gillis, and Brian Walker. And just listeners, our next Hedge School will be on the War of Independence in Cork, which Brian talked about earlier. And incidentally, we'll be returning to the conflict in Belfast. And Brian, I'm hoping to recruit you for that one as well. But so listeners, just keep an eye on our website and in the magazine for news of those. We do hope to be back with you soon live, but for the moment, we will be coming to you by the wonders of technology. So thanks very much for listening, and hope you tune in for the next Hedge School. Thank you very much.